I think we'll kick things off. Thanks for coming on today. A little bit about myself. My name is Tim Gorse. I'm from Melbourne. I work for the NAB. I've been in superannuation now for a year, so not that long. Been with NABGRIP for quite some time, so I started as an actuary in MIC, doing a whole bunch of things. I then went and spent 6 or 7 years in the bank at Melbourne, learning a bit about banking, and more recently been back in corporate superannuation. So a little bit about NAB. Well, it's got about $60 billion in superannuation balances and three different RSEL, so quite a big player in superannuation, and therefore today's topic is one that's of a lot of interest to the NAB. A little bit about Ben. So Ben, thank you, Ben, for coming today. He's going to join me and present a few thoughts that you probably all know, Ben. Being a Sydney boy, I'm a Melbourne boy, so nice to meet you all. Ben works at Deloitte. Ben and I actually collaborated a little bit this year together with Peter Larson on some of the things we're talking about today. So I guess a lot of you come along because you're interested, probably superannuation background. Hands up who's got a superannuation background today. Oh, not that many. I'll keep this kind of general. We're talking about a case study today in risk management, reflecting on some of the regulation changes that have come through in the last little while around stronger super and the opportunity this presents to tighten up risk management in super funds. We're going to deep dive into a couple of case studies, a couple of themes. Ben will do that. I'll speak a little more generally up front. Ben and I think we'll talk for sort of 40 minutes max. We'd like to stretch that out a bit further by having your participation, questions, discussion. So just jump in if you want to add a point, and we'll have some questions at the end. So today's session is around super fund risk and capital management, and a little bit about my background. I happened to be working for the bank around the same time as Basel II came in and was being implemented. And I remember at the time that was a massive piece of regulatory change for the big banks in Australia. Extremely costly, like we were looking at the numbers and they were blowing out and, is this really worth it, the amount of money we're spending on this? But personally, having been someone who has seen those models put in place around the advanced accredited models used for managing risk within the banks, and seen those filter down into decisions made right down to the bankers at the front line who decide whether or not a credit risk is worth taking for the price that they can get. I think it's fair to say that that's been a good thing for the Australian banks, and there is a strong case, there's probably for and against, but there is a strong case to say it helped the big banks navigate through the GFC. They didn't bring on business that you find a lot of businesses in America brought on, banks in America brought on that caused a lot of trouble through the GFC. Now, arguably, is that all Basel II? Maybe, maybe not, but I'm actually an advocate for what Basel II has done for banks. And having been working superannuation, I've seen some of those some of those worried looks from executives this year in the superannuation industry around how much stronger super is actually costing. And I think, it is expensive. As I said, the biggest super regulatory change in 20 years. Expensive and controversial. Controversial are those who are actually trying to fund the change, I think, more than anything. Now, this is costing a lot of money. But I think what Ben and I will agree on today and be interested in thoughts from the floor here is it does provide a very strong basis for enhanced risk management. And a bit like the banks, those who treated Basel II as a compliance project managed to get it in, get their license, but then found themselves having to spend a lot more money actually putting in place changes to business which made the most of the requirements of Basel II. We're going to say today, pretty well super funds are in the same boat. You can try to jam it in as a compliance exercise, or you can sit back and say, let's actually try to enhance our risk management. Let's try to run our super fund like it's a business that's in the members' interest. Of course, they look different to a bank which is trying to service shareholders predominantly and deposit holders. But let's actually make the most of this opportunity. And that's the theme that you'll get from me, that we think there is an opportunity to use stronger super as an opportunity to improve risk management. So Again, if I just go through the high level, why would you want to approve risk management? What are some of the goals? I'm not going to read through these goals right now, except to say that these are the sort of risk management goals that any enterprise would have. So improving strategy setting, guided by a good understanding of risk appetite, making better selection of business opportunities, again guided by a good understanding of risks, prioritising risk management activity, identifying risks, managing, mitigating risks. These are things that any business is trying to achieve. And one of the things that I think is really important for super funds to understand is the whole superannuation industry with its $1.4 trillion of money, the time has come to really mature in how they run themselves, and risk management is central to that. Yes, it is costly to embark upon really good risk management. Now, there are expenses, undoubtedly. But for a system which is as big as superannuation system, the time has come for super funds to either generate the scale they need to run a professional risk management or framework, or consider getting out. Well, I think in some ways the strongest superannuation is sort of making that and come to the fore. It's a very expensive piece of legislation to comply with and would probably be difficult if you're a small superannuation fund. But ultimately, it's the sort of thing that is necessary if you want to run a sustainable long-term business. So the difference between a super fund as a business and any other business is probably who that business is serving, and ultimately it's about servicing the members of that super fund. So what's in it for the members? Well, I think operational surprises and operational events are not in the interests of members. Yes, you ultimately have a third party administrator that quite often cops up and makes good. There are some exceptions, but I think for the whole industry and the integrity of the industry, it is in the interest of everyone playing in the industry to try to whistle out operational surprises. Good risk management is preemptive to try to stop those events happening in the first place. And ultimately what will happen if that is achieved is retirement insurance outcomes for members will be enhanced. All that happens when you've got an industry which has risk in it is you've got to charge for that risk. And there is probably an element of risk premium in the sorts of fees that members are paying right now for things that could go wrong. Potentially there is an opportunity to cut costs through enhanced risk management. Maybe a long bow to draw, but that's my kind of thesis on why risk management is important to superannuation funds. Just looking through a little bit about the stronger super changes, I know I've got a few APRA people here today. Feel free to dive in. I'm misrepresenting all the great work you've done in putting forward these strong super changes, but I think there's three very basic themes that a superannuation fund or the trustees thereof need to start building a risk management framework around. So first is ensuring that you've got a solid framework in place. So trustee board must understand and manage their risks within a clearly defined framework. Better managing individual risk types. So key risks need to be managed appropriately. And reserving for risks is something that's maybe not foreign to a lot of super funds. There's always been an element of reserving for risk, but I think what Basel 2 did for banks is just lifting that up to a new level. Internal advanced models was the banking case study, and starting to get quite strong and best practice in a world sense on how risk and capital are managed. I'm not sure super funds are being able to go quite to that level, but they're certainly being asked to do a bit more work on that, particularly around operational risk. So they are, at the high level, what I see as being the enhancements. And if you then kind of take it down to what is actually being rolled out in superannuation, there's been a whole plethora of standards which have come out. Can't rattle off the number off it. It had to be 13 or 14 new prudential standards that superannuation trustees have been asked to put in place. And again, I think they do anchor broadly around those themes that I mentioned. SPS 220 is about having a trustee having a very strong risk management framework in place. there's then been a bunch of standards which speak to individual risk types. The old ones that actuaries have always played in, funding risk around defined benefit plans, then a whole bunch of requirements to tighten up risk management around that, insurance, investment governance, quite a bit around operational risk, trustee fund governance. And then obviously around the way that capital is held within superannuation funds. So it's quite a bit that the superannuation industry has been asked to do this year. Again, back to the central theme of what we're saying, you can either you can either just treat that as compliance exercise, or you can take the opportunity to really do some meaningful changes to how you manage risk as a superannuation fund. So that's sort of the high level around Stronger Super. Again, I appreciate there's quite a few people today who aren't working in superannuation. For those who are working in superannuation, it's been a really big year. I expect you've all worked really hard to get some of this legislative change in place. And it's a really big thing for the superannuation industry. So you've probably read bits and pieces from the press. It is controversial, but underneath it all is an opportunity to improve and enhance risk management. And what Ben and I want to do now, and I'll hand it over to Ben just in a moment, is we want to talk about a couple of things that we found particularly interesting and just want to deep dive into a little bit. The first one is Operational Risk Financial Requirement, or ORFR. And the ORFR is about setting up reserves within super funds to fund operational risk events. And actuaries managing reserves in super funds is not a new thing. There's defined benefit plans have always had a reserve for funding member benefits and maybe a reserve for self-insurance in some cases and other reserves, and actuaries have always helped manage the transition of those reserves between trustees. So it's not new in one sense, managing reserves. I think what ORFR is going to do though is make this mainstream in a sense, the need to manage reserves for their purpose, but also as those reserves move between funds. And a couple of challenges that Ben will deep dive into is how do you do that in a way which is equitable across members? A whole bunch of scenarios you can come up with where maybe one fund has raised a reserve which is more than another fund, and then those funds merge together, and what do you do with the reserves? And we find that a really interesting actuarial challenge to make sure that's all done in a way which is fair. A little bit about ORFR and conglomerate structure. So I work for a conglomerate, being a NAB group. We've got Susan here from ANZ. So there's some interesting challenges around setting up an operational risk reserve in a super fund which is owned within a conglomerate structure, and doing that in a way which harmonises with all the other capital that's required to be held by that conglomerate structure. Risk assessment of super funds, I want to make a few comments on that, just because in a way, that's the low-hanging fruit in terms of managing risk in a super fund. Just going right back to the basics of, do we understand what our risks are? Do we have a plan to manage those risks? Do we understand how extreme those risks might get if they really blew up on us? Some of the really basic stuff, the legislation has come out through Stronger Super. It's forced a lot of trustees to go back and answer those very basic questions. And then finally, Ben and I have done a fair bit of work in this space. There's other people in this room who have done a fair bit of work in this space. We think there's an opportunity for the actuarial profession to start providing some thought leadership around a whole bunch of new issues that are going to arise in super. And interestingly, I believe most of them are non-DB. DB, the traditional ground that actuaries have claimed for their own, I think the bulk of the issues going forward are actually DC. I think DB is pretty well... it's in rundown. It's I think it's quite well managed. The protocols and the processes, APRA and the actuarial profession have built up around that. I think the real hunting ground is DC, and certainly around ORFR. Potentially you're going to have to ask for some actuarial advice every time super funds move between trustees, or big chunks of super funds exit a particular super fund around member equity. And I think the actual profession probably could spend a bit of time doing some research on what is the best way, the protocols, the principles to ensure that member equity across the industry is preserved with these big reserves moving in and out. So that's my long introduction. Is there any comments before I pass it over to Ben, who's going to do a little bit of deep dive for us on these themes? Okay, I'll pass it to you, Ben. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim, and everyone here today. Since then, my name's Ben. I work for Deloitte Actors and Consultants. I've been working in the superannuation industry for about 20 years now. Susan and I go back a very long way to my old days at Mercer prior to Deloitte. Tim mentioned a superannuation industry of $1.4 trillion. It goes up and down a little bit. That sounds pretty big. Just this week, however, Deloitte has put out its latest biennial projection of the superannuation industry, Dynamics of Super, we call it. Projects the industry out for the next 20 years. And the latest projections there actually put the industry not at $1.4 trillion in 20 years' time, but at $7.6 trillion in 20 years' time. So this is an industry that's growing exponentially and will continue to do so. So I'm going to touch or focus here a bit on operational risk and ORFA in superannuation, as I like to call it. Given that many of you aren't in superannuation, quick background on that. ORFA is basically a new capital requirement under the prudential standards for superannuation funds, which requires them to hold capital to cover their potential operational risks. And there is a minimum of 25 basis points, with some exceptions, 25 basis points worth of capital to be held. So 25 basis points, 0.25%, doesn't sound that much. When you think we've got a $1.4, $1.5, $1.6 trillion industry, we're talking more than $3 billion sitting here in operational risk and capital reserves, which, if our projections pan out over the next 20 years, could be five times that amount. Significant amount of money, and it's certainly worth trustees putting a lot of effort into how that is actually managed. And offer and member equity and general funding is actually, I think, one of the key areas around how offer is managed. And one of these key areas that Tim touched on was the transferability of offer between funds. And just to illustrate that, let me take a step back and give you two broad structures for how a fund's membership is structured. We've got one type of fund whereby it's effectively a collection of individuals. And by a collection of individuals, I'm talking about a traditional industry fund, for instance, or a retail personal type fund. We've got, certainly you might have a number of individuals there from one employer, but they're all in there as individuals, so to speak. Then the second type is where the fund is like a collection of sub-plans. And those sub-plans are generally being described by employers. So what we're talking about here is the retail and wholesale master trusts, those run by Mercer, by Aon, and by Russell, and so on. And then you've also got on the retail side, then you've got NAB, MLC, you've got VT, you've got First State, and so on. Then you've also got, more recently, corporate divisions within industry funds. So those industry funds that used to be just a collection of individuals, a number of them now are tacking on corporate sub-plans. Now the reason for this sub-plan structure was for a corporate who was outsourcing their standalone superannuation fund to retain their identity as a distinct super fund, but within a larger super fund. And at the same time, particularly when it came to DB funds, to manage the finances of that sub-plan as well. Now, that's particularly important when considering these types of funds and in relation to operational risk capital and how that's funded and how that's held. These corporate sub-plans, they might change. I'm going through some tenders at the moment, for instance, whereby a large standalone corporate fund is looking to outsource, move to a multi-employer fund. Going through another tender where a corporation has several of these multi-employer sub-plans, they want to bring them together and move them to another, potentially, corporate subplan within a master trust. So a question which arises in relation to operational risk is when one of these big entities comes into a multi-employer fund, if they don't bring any operational risk capital with them, they're actually diluting the level of capital that's held within that fund, and obviously diluting it more if it's a big fund coming in relative to the fund that it's actually coming into. So is there or should there be a requirement, are trustees going to put in place a requirement for these funds to bring some capital with them, such that that operational risk is not, operational risk capital is not diluted? But then, think about the complexities around that. 5 years' time, 10 years' time, whenever it might be, that corporation decides, I might like to move to another provider now. Should they actually be allowed to take that money away with them to their new corporation, because they've provided it? If they don't take it with them and they go to the new fund, that new fund might say, well, give me some money now, so they're double paying. So this is just giving you a hint of some of the issues, or an issue that that might be faced in the management of this of operational risk. Now, what we're seeing in the market now, in fact, the market is not far enough into this regime to really see what providers are going to do. We're seeing some providers say, look, we've already funded our offer, so you don't need to bring anything with you. Others are saying, yes, you need to bring your 25 basis points or whatever it is with you. And I think the decision there might form around how big this incoming fund is relative to the fund they're coming into. I'm seeing at the moment a fund whereby it would increase its assets by around 20% as a result of this fund coming in. That's a significant dilution if they don't bring capital in. But assuming then that a sub-plan is able to, or is, does bring in its capital with it, and assuming that it takes that capital away with it if it goes somewhere else as well, think about some of the issues that might happen in that interim period. What if the membership and the assets of that sub-plan change significantly in that interim period? What happens if they've gone up? What happens if they've doubled? When offer capital is a percentage of assets, 25 basis points, does that sub-plan get to take away 25 basis points of their new assets, which are much larger? What happens if those assets have gone down significantly? Do they take away less than what they put in the first place? Some of the issues that these trustees need to consider. What happens if the trustee alters their target offer capital during that period? So what was originally 25 points, the trustee decides at some point, look, we actually think we need to hold a little bit more, we think it needs to be 30 basis points. Should that fund then take away 30 basis points rather than 25 that they put? And then what happens if a significant event, an incident, has occurred in that period? In a way, the capital, the offer, is in replenishment mode. Trustees having to prop that back up, but it's currently underfunded. What happens if that event was not related to that particular subplan, but that particular subplan's portion of the capital has been used up to an extent to fund that event? Does that subplan get taken away less? What happens if that event did relate to that subplan? Do they bear the entire cost of that event, or is it spread amongst the other subplans? So these are some real issues that providers and trustees are going to have to consider. And in some cases, they may be sorted out through policies that the trustee puts in place now and discuss and agree with their incoming plans when that actually occurs. Well, there could be some commercial terms involved there. They make some agreement in the participation agreement as to what will actually happen in those circumstances. Now, these are some issues around managing that capital and around determining what is a fair amount of capital to be redistributed to a fund of leads that actuaries can have a significant involvement in helping trustees and providers. Then, what about the issue of equitably funding for events, and in particular, who's responsible for the replenishment of capital when it actually gets used up? And there's two schools of thought here around how you can consider that. One is that when an event occurs, the members or the cohort of members at that time are the ones who have to replenish the offer. And that's over a period of generally something up to 3 years. So after all, those are the members that were actually there when the event occurred. They're the ones that have got the benefit from that capital. They're the ones that should actually be funding that back up to the target. So that's one level, one way of thinking. Another way of thinking is considering the operational risk capital as like insurance. So what a trustee might do here, and a member might consider, is a member pays small premium each year as insurance against operational risk, operational risk that might occur in that particular fund. If an event doesn't occur, the member doesn't get their money back. They've paid their insurance and they're happy because they've got that peace of mind that they haven't been hit by a big event. So it's very much like your car insurance and your home insurance. And if it does, if a big event does occur, they're covered because there's the capital there. What that actually requires, however, in a way, is a lot of consideration around what should that premium actually be. Because when you think about it, the fund would actually need to build up a level of capital probably above its target 25 basis points, such that when a big event occurs, they don't need to significantly replenish the capital. The ongoing premium can just continue to cover that. So they'll actually have to have a buffer in there. So those two schools of thought, and different people think different ways. And a trustee has got to think about what their philosophy is around how they fund that capital, and particularly if it's an insurance-type approach, the level of involvement that actuaries can have in helping them to understand what that premium should be in order to ensure that risks are adequately covered and that there's less likelihood of the fund actually having to go cap in hand evaporate at some point and say, well, sorry, I've breached my tolerance, and I'm going to have to replenish these assets. And then we've got the issues of operational risk and conglomerates. And I think operational risk has created some significant additional challenges for conglomerates over your traditional corporate or industry funds. These entities, which often manage tens of billions of dollars, to mention that, you know, the NAB plans manage in the order of $60 billion. It's a lot of money, and hence a lot of money held in operational risk capital. These entities are required to comply with the ORFA requirements in the same way that any other fund is required to, and that's fair enough. However, their structures are fairly unique in that quite often they might invest these funds, these $60 billion, through related funds management arms. Or they might invest those funds through insurance policies of an insurer that's within the group. They might be administered, or they might be insured through related entities within the group. And there also may be a level of indemnity that's in place, such that when one of those related parties starts up, they pay. And quite often they do just pay, almost no question asked. In some cases, those indemnities are quite strong legally. Now, the challenge there is that these organisations are often required, or in some cases just do voluntarily, hold capital already within their conglomerate structures for operational risk. So it might be regulated capital in relation to the insurance entities, for instance, or it might be a more voluntary internal capital in relation to unregulated entities, such as fund management businesses, for instance. Now, within ORFA, there is actually an offset for the level of capital that's held by insurance entities when a fund does invest through those insurance or other APRA regulated entities. But how much should that offset be? How much of that 25 basis points should disappear? And how should the trustee be dealing with other capital that might be voluntarily held within the conglomerate structure as well? And these are areas where, again, actuaries can help. Now, these conglomerates also have a number of them do have internal capital models in place, and some of these models are incredibly complex. They're certainly way over my head. Highly sophisticated models. But unfortunately, it's not actually always that straightforward to say to one of these models, now, can you produce an extra number for me for my superannuation entities? It just doesn't work like that. For a number of reasons. One, there's little internal data, often, in relation to superannuation entities. Two, there's no external data in relation to superannuation entities, like there is the banking industry. Three, these models might be calibrated to different confidence levels, 99.5 in relation to insurance, 99.9 in relation to banking. How can these entities actually take these models and switch them over and produce a superannuation entity? Now, what these conglomerates also have to deal with in practical circumstances is the complexity of diversification of risk. So when you've got all of these elements of the business administering, investing the superannuation assets, as well as other aspects of the conglomerate's business as well, they get a diversification of risk. So a 1 in 100 loss for the superannuation business and a 1 in 100 loss for the other businesses, you don't add them together to get a 1 in 100 loss for the conglomerate as a whole. There's a diversification element there. However, now that we've got this ORPA in place, ORPA has to stand on its own. The ORPA capital has to be held within the trustee or the fund and stand on its own on an undiversified basis. So these conglomerates actually now have an added level of capital. They can't have the same level of diversification of that capital in place. So how can they actually manage that level of capital that they hold in a way that's optimal for the conglomerate? Now, getting back to these models, I mentioned that they're complex, they can't be just switched on to produce a superannuation figure. It doesn't mean they should be thrown out. They actually are a really good starting point for, and I've worked with a couple, a good starting point for developing an understanding of a super entity's operational risk. But I can understand why APRA says, we're not going to rely on that risk. We're not going to let you say my model produces 20 basis points and therefore you can have 20 and not 25. I can understand that because the model's not set up for superannuation. But the low-hanging fruit is still to use those models for these components, actually build upon them, build up a dialogue with APRA so that over a period of years, APRA can actually come to understand the models and that the conglomerates themselves can come to understand the models and how they apply to superannuation and hopefully ultimately get a fairly accurate sort of figure out. But ultimately, assessing operational risk is not about coming up with a capital number. It's not about coming up with a figure, whether that's 10 basis points, 25 basis points, 100 basis points, whatever it is. Assessment of operational and broader risk is actually about understanding, mitigating, managing and reserving for risk in a manner which has optimal cost-benefit outcomes for the superannuation fund, for the conglomerate, for whatever entity it actually is. Unfortunately, I think we're far from that goal in superannuation. When I look at risk management in superannuation, and I'm generalising, obviously, there's a wide range of levels of sophistication in the industry. But generalising, when I look at the level of risk management and risk assessment in superannuation, I find that it's often done at too high a level. It's not taking into account enough detail. It's not bringing into play the experts that are involved that might be assessed at the board or the management level, but not bringing in the people that actually manage the process and the payments whereby these operational risks can actually come about. The outcomes may not be grounded in reality. To give you an example, one particular service provider that I know of, when I look at the expected annual loss from their risk register, it's 40% of their revenue. It's not grounded in reality. And I think the superannuation industry is a little bit behind in that area. There's a lack of understanding of the potential extremities of risk. And again, an example I like to hear is that in 2003, CSS PSS, the big government fund, actually had a fraud event worth $150 million. I see some entities that are twice the size of CSS PSS assessing fraud risk at half that level at a 1 in 1,000 view probability. So I think there's a lack of understanding of what the potential opportunities are or the potential extremities of risk actually are. There's too much focus on the past. I hear trustees say that we haven't lost any money in this space before. Why do we need to hold capital for it? But the market's still immature. In reality, the superannuation system, in its more modern form, has only been around for 10, 20 years. That extreme loss may just not have occurred as yet. And at the same time, it's a fast-moving market. It's huge growth. I mentioned 1.4 trillion to 7.6 trillion in 20 years. And it's moved from, a couple of hundred billion 20 years ago to where it is now. New technologies, new services for members, new regulations that come in all create operational risk. Some of the biggest risks that I actually see, or incidents that I see occur, actually come from providers getting new legislation wrong and not actually understanding that they've got it wrong for a number of years and end up costing millions to fix it up. And I also think that in the market, the progress of incidents within an entity is not well managed or measured. So understanding risk tolerances and how you're actually progressing against those risk tolerances and when to jump in and actually put in greater controls because you're getting close to what those tolerances are and what your risk appetite actually is. We're not very good at doing that in the industry. All of these things, to mention that we've been managing defined benefit funds, actually have been working defined benefit funds for donkey's years now, that's managing risk. It's managing any specific financial risk. There are so many areas that I've talked about here whereby the superannuation industry, I think, is probably behind the game a little bit, where actuaries, I think, just key and very well placed to step forward and actually help trustees and providers in that particular area. So, actuarial professional involvement, I think I've been through this, to be quite honest. I really do think that we need to step up as a profession. I think we're very good at the quantitative bits of assessing risk. We may not be as good yet at the more qualitative aspects of assessing risk, understand mitigants and how they work. And I think actuaries can be thinking a little bit more and getting some positions around that and increasing our own level of intellectual capital around how we do that. Because let's face it, whilst I think we're very good at managing risk, and I think we're very well placed, we aren't the only ones that are actually going to be in this market. I'm not the only ones that are in the market now. So we are competing against non-actuaries. We need to show that we can have the quantitative aspects of risk assessment as well as the qualitative aspects. And that'll put actuaries, I think, just well ahead of any other profession in this particular area. So that's what we wanted to cover. We covered our half hour or 40 minutes or so. And open it up to questions or discussion. Were there any controversial aspects in what we mentioned there about what actuaries can do and what we think the industry can do that it's worth talking through?
Question for Tim, a very interesting subject matter. Based on what you're saying about conglomerates, what sort of impact do you think you'll have for the sort of the big firms in terms of their superannuation components? Do you see sort of maybe parts of it being sort of set aside or business changes? For example, I'm picking a NAB as an example, but you see conglomerates.
Is that in terms of the reserve that we might operational risk reserve for a for one of our sub funds?
More change in the conglomerate's business model. What do you think? How business will have to change to cope with these changing capital requirements?
So I think what's one important point that Ben made is that there is a fair amount of segregation between the superannuation capital and the rest of the capital that a conglomerate would have to hold to meet prudential requirements. And I'm not sure if anyone's seen the Level 3 conglomerate proposals that have come out. They request we segregate a conglomerate's capital into different blocks, and there's a banking block, a life insurance block, and one of those blocks is a super block. And the way that the guidance has been given is, whilst you can take into account where that superannuation money is being invested through into another APRA-regulated vehicle and reduce the capital because of that, generally the minimum of 25 will apply for that superannuation block. And so it is reasonably segregated. I think a couple of things that we're seeing in the NAB is the ability to take into account that those offsets is a compelling, what we think is the right thing to do, firstly, in terms of that APRA guidance, because it's double counting of capital, yeah, and the member pays for twice. So that is important. And I guess for the structures, in some ways, there's no free lunch with this. If you are investing through into a life company and your headline capital for your operational risk reserve is less, that's because the member is probably already paying a higher fee by virtue of there being life insurance capital that they're having to rent, for want of a better term. So I think the way the legislation's been structured is such that we can't see any real arbitrage opportunities that might cause us to change our business model. But what we are seeing more generally, back to my very opening comments, is the compliance requirement on superannuation business now means that we need to seriously think about streamlining how we manage our different superannuation affairs. I know in the organisation I work for, there are several superannuation funds. Some of them invest into other funds, and that's not exactly optimal right now in terms of operational reserve, there's a whole bunch of things. And where you've got several funds and several trustee entities, you're doubling, tripling up on the amount of compliance work you need to do. And probably the most fundamental change is now's probably the right time to start to rationalise and simplify some of those entity structures. Because super's only going to get bigger, and the costs of compliance need to be probably brought down a little by being a little simpler in the way we structure things.
Mike, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Without giving away any commercial information, obviously, but we're working for a provider of multi-employer funds in AL. Is there any thinking or any views that you have around the treatment of ORFA within Master Trust, multi-employer funds, and moving capital in and out when clients come and leave the fund?
I agree with your assessment that there's a lot of work that's going to be done in the future in that area. I don't think, again, in our own case, we haven't given a lot of thought. I was thinking about it while you were talking there, and my starting point would be it's a fund-level scenario, and it needs to be done at fund level to try and do that at sub-plan level, and particularly then try and allocate actual events at sub-plan level. I mean, at the end of the day, if it's an administration event, all of the sub-plans are given the Aon Master Trust the admin function. If we screw up somewhere on one of those funds, why should that fund be the one that has to pay for it? It's a thought that I had when you were talking there on that one. I guess it would be nice to have to deal with the problem because somebody wants to bring in 20 or 30% of our assets tomorrow. It would be not nice to deal with the problem if someone wants to take it away. But the commercial reality certainly would be that the inclination, if you weren't required to give it away when they left, then you wouldn't be voluntarily doing so. Is a commercial reality. You're right, in terms of the large fund transfers, I can see that it will become potentially part of the commercial participation agreement side of things. And certainly if large employers are looking for some commitment on the way out, then the corollary to that is that they'll be paying for it on the way in.
Yeah, I certainly agree with your point that you can't allocate incidents necessarily to a particular subplan. There's got to be an element of insurance in there. It's got to be an element of sharing. And as you say, everyone gets administered. And just because one fund, one subplan was the unlucky one in which something happened, it doesn't mean that that subplan should be the one that pays. There is an element of insurance and who would be sharing involved there. I suppose one point about office capital, which I didn't mention, but we should, is that to a large extent, this has been happening for a long time. Within the conglomerate structures, for instance, the banks and so on, they knew they would make errors. They knew everyone makes errors. Operational risks happen all the time, and external events happen that they can't control as well. And so in order for a conglomerate to make profit, it needs to build in an expectation of those errors into its pricing. So there's an element of insurance premium in there already. The industry funds have been building up reserves, a number of them, for years. And that comes through an element of premium, so to speak, coming out of the investment returns. The difference is now we've got a formalised structure of holding that capital and a formalised structure for replenishing that capital when an event actually occurs, when a large event, a series of those actually occurs.
And if I may add one of, not completely across the technical detail of this, but it's a relatively restricted range of events which you can use your ORF for.
Yep.
And so there's an awful lot of risk events that you've got to handle at the trustee level that are not operational risk events.
Yes.
And this capital requirement is only relating to that, and there's some very specific uses about what can and can't be done in that from 1 July onwards.
Yep.
Our fund did have some operational risk reserve already. It's not as big as 0.25%, and so there's a plan to build it. Certainly some of the ins and outs to that reserve will be slightly different, or even different in future than the past. There are certain things which clearly are operational risk events, in my mind at least, but not in APRA's mind.
Yes.
That's something that the funds have all got to deal with.
I completely agree, and if I stood up at an ASFA conference and said this, I'd probably be shocked, but I actually think that the ORFA requirements don't go far enough. And why do I think that? For that very reason, and when you particularly focus on a not-for-profit fund, an industry fund, it doesn't matter where a loss came from. It doesn't matter whether it meets this narrow definition of operational risk or the broader definition of operational risk or the wider definition of risk altogether. The money's going to come from somewhere to fix it. When you've got a not-for-profit fund, where does the money come from? It has to come from reserves or from the members' balances in some way. So I actually think that the requirement for reserving, whilst maybe not in a strict formulaic manner, I think actually needs to go broader than just a narrow definition of operational risk and have trustees consider the wider risks that they are exposed to and consider what they think is an appropriate level of reserving and management in relation to those risks. Don't quote me on that, Jim. Next time this group's a great one.
And I would I'd absolutely get a shot if I subscribe to that if you're working for a conglomerate, because one of the things we've looked at is who are all the businesses within our conglomerate structure that service the trustee, and how much capital, you know, at the group level through things like our economic capital framework, and how much capital is notionally or real in a real sense there. And banks are very well capitalised organisations. You know, I think, you know, AA rated, aspirations of higher ratings. There's going to be a lot of capital. that would be available in an operational event. So
that's Australian banks you're referring to.
Australian banks. So one of the things that NAB has struggled with a little bit is harmonising SPS 114 with all the other capital that's being held, and is that actually optimal for members and shareholder collectively? So
that's an important point. I think it's important that we do improve how we treat operational risk capital and all forms of capital within a conglomerate across the conglomerate rather than in its environment.
I'll ask you something different. I was interested in your views as to how trustee boards are dealing with, well, not just the whole raft of changes coming through, but specifically the ORFR. What has been the level of testing almost of operational risk and incidents coming through, and then the adequacy of the ORFR that follows? And that's irrespective of the 25 pips that APRA's put in place, which, you know, may go up or down, up probably, you know, in the future, depending on what comes through.
I'll take you back to that slide on that one. There is a wide range of practice in the industry, and the conglomerates in particular put a lot of effort into understanding their operational risk because it's part of their culture. But there are a number of other funds, smaller funds, that have been quite high level in putting together their operational risk capital. Now, they've relied upon the 25 basis points, which is probably going to be enough anyway, so as long as they're not going to be holding enough. But at the same time, I don't think they've put enough thought into what their true operational risk exposure actually is. And partly they're hamstrung because they don't necessarily have record of their operational risk history or experience to rely upon and understand what their true exposure has actually been. Going forward, though, we're still in very early days, and I do hope that all trustees do continue to monitor in a better way their operational risk and exposure such that they can, it can be a feedback loop into that capital that they hold.
Can I maybe share a case study from the organisation I work for in the NAB? Because it's been a real journey of discovery for the trustees issue with this the idea of risk and operational risk capital modelling. We ended up relying quite heavily on good old-fashioned empirical historical loss analysis, just going back, looking at the events we had, helping the trustee to understand what has actually happened in the last 20 years or so, doing scenarios on for the different risk classes that in their risk management strategy. You know, how bad could things get, sort of pulling the levers and just try to dynamically show how big an impact could be from something going wrong. We didn't push so much into the detailed internal loss distribution modelling that you might do in a bank, simply because there just is no data there to play with in the superannuation context. That said, at one stage we actually brought in our sort of head of quantitative analysis, the guy who builds all the ABI models for the bank on operational risk, and he shared some thoughts around the nuances of operational risk capital modeling with the trustee. It's kind of over the head. This is a new world I think trustee boards are entering. You know, they're on a journey. Maybe 5 years, 10 years from now, the expectation is superannuation funds are systemically as important as banks and need to have the same level of maturity around managing and modelling operational risk capital. You know, maybe this is right now, it's just the start of what's a longer term journey. But I think it's fair to say our trustee boards within this country are going to need a few years to mature into that. And I think this year has been their level of maturity has risen around operational risk capital model, but it's still got a long way to go in terms of getting to where the banks are at.
I think scenario analysis is one of the most important things, and that all trustees need to work harder at and work more on. The main reason for that is that, if I can throw some stats up here, one I'm working on at the moment, when I have a look at their data, 5% of their number of incidents created 88% of the value of their losses. And that's because when the big ones happen, they happen in a big way. And so an entity that really thoroughly considers through, considers what those potential extreme outcomes are in scenario analysis, does it in a way that sits the various experts from their business in different areas into the inner room, and goes through a workshop approach whereby they set out a scenario, set out a particular situation that could happen on a 1 in 100 or whatever basis, and work through their business. If this happened, how would it affect you in your end? How would it affect you? How would it affect you? And then when all those effects are sort of worked out, then they say, well, as a result of this, what other risks might actually occur? Because, for instance, a large risk occurs which pulls these huge, a bunch of processing staff to fix it. They work hard. They work overtime. They leave a pocket in the BAU processing team. Does that actually heighten the risk of more processing errors actually occurring as well? So they go through that in the scenario analysis as well and try to understand in that extreme circumstance what is that big loss that could actually occur. And sure, it's only one incident, one event, or they might do it over a whole series of risk categories, 8 to 10 categories. But if you get those right, you actually get the vast bulk of your potential loss dollars right. So that's where it's particularly important. And only the, I think only the biggest of the funds are actually doing that well now, and even some of them aren't. Well, thank you. Thanks for coming along today, and hope it was useful, and you learned a little bit about superannuation for those that don't work in super, and about off-risk for those that do. Thanks very much.